Thanks for coming along tonight, where Rose Jackson makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. She'll be known to you, but I'll introduce her briefly. So the Honourable Rose Jackson, MLC, Member of the Legislative Council, Minister for Water, for Housing, Homelessness and a few other things. She graduated from the University of Sydney in Law and Economics, became a trade union official with United Voice, and also worked in the Labor Party head office, and of course then became a Member of Parliament, and after that, a minister in the Minns Labor government. So, and the topic for tonight's talk is, why is it difficult to make change in government? Rose Jackson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here tonight with the Sydney Institute. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we meet, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and pay my respects to elders past and present, and extend that respect and acknowledgement to any Aboriginal people joining us for tonight's conversation. I'd like to thank Jared and the Sydney Institute for the invitation to speak this evening, and it is truly a testament to the deep commitment of the Institute to free speech, open dialogue and the power of ideas that you would invite me, one of the oft described, not necessarily by myself, although it's not a label that I'm uncomfortable with, most progressive members of the New South Wales Labor government. And yes, perhaps strange bedfellows, but it is this spirit and sentiment of unexpected minds meeting that will form the theme of my comments tonight. And as has been mentioned, I will take as my topic, why is it so bloody hard to solve complex problems in government? And I will do some admiration of the problem and some attribution of blame, but because I get particularly bored by just talking about challenges and particularly excited talking about solutions, I will venture some thoughts on what we might do to address this problem. So the obvious complex problem that I personally am grappling with is housing. It is simply not accessible or affordable in Sydney. Middle-class people with decently paying jobs have lost their grasp on our housing market. The average income required to purchase a home in Sydney is close to $300,000. Forbes recently reported that the average income in Sydney was closer to $80,000. So the nexus between working hard and having a good life, being able to get that foothold in the property market, has been broken. And this is a very sad and dangerous thing for a city like Sydney. It's stymieing our economic prosperity because people cannot live near where they work. And they spend hours of productive time every day on the deeply unproductive task of sitting in traffic or on public transport. And this makes them stressed and unhappy. It inhibits economic growth because working people are spending too much of their income on housing, meaning there is less discretionary spending to support a vibrant culinary scene or cultural scene or a strong retail sector, or even better, starting new businesses or investing in new skills. There's no money left for anything fun or productive or new or interesting after property has hoovered it all up. We are losing a generation of the brightest and most talented people from our city. The Productivity Commission recently noted that double the number of 30 to 40 year olds left Sydney than arrived in recent years. And housing costs are the principal driving factor, driving people away from Sydney. And what a shockingly dull and lifeless place our city will be if this trend is not arrested. And of course, the hollowing out of future Sydney says nothing about the consequences of housing inequality for the most vulnerable. As housing becomes unaffordable, and in particular the rental market experiences record high rent increases and record low vacancy rates, people who were otherwise in precarious but bearable housing at the bottom end of the rental market are falling out altogether. And they are experiencing forms of homelessness or becoming tenants of social housing at alarmingly increasing rates. And this spiraling inequality makes our cities more unsafe places to live, to work, and to raise your family. The social safety net that should be there for people is buckling and it's full of holes. So yes, it's grim. Housing is a major and complex challenge. It's the type of complex challenge that it is almost impossible to confront. complex in that there is not one solution. There isn't one program we can fund, one policy we can change. It's not as though around government, instead of doing this, we could do that and the problem would be solved. No, it's complex in that it requires different levels of government doing lots of different things at the same and similar times, and many of them are expensive. And what I think is particularly challenging about housing is as we have conversations about why it's so hard to solve complex problems in government, this is an example of one where you're trying to fix the plane as you're flying it. And that is one area that is very difficult for government to confront. So, as I said, though, I don't intend to really use this speech to go into the detail of how to confront the housing market. There's plenty of housing crisis. There's plenty of opportunities for me to do that elsewhere. What I want to talk about is why our current political system is so acutely ill-suited to confronting complex challenges of this type. Things that take time to solve, solutions that eschew sound bites, problems that we can solve, but as I said, not easily or quickly, and where the tsunami of challenges associated with the problem are pushing right up against the time and energy and effort it takes to solve them. So for some context, tonight it is almost exactly 1 year since the new cabinet of the New South Wales Labor government was sworn in. On Thursday this week, it will be 1 year since the cabinet was announced. And on Friday this week, we were sworn in to our respective positions 1 year ago. So as a consequence of that, and as expected, we were now tasked with addressing the numerous challenges facing the state of New South Wales, amongst them, of course, my top priority, confronting the housing crisis. And after a year, let me assure you that the luxuries of opposition are a distant memory. Opposition, of course, and I did spend a number of years there, is all care and no responsibility. The lack of media interest infuriated us at the time. There was nothing worse than calling a press conference to announce the opposition policy on something and absolutely no one showed up. Now, of course, that lack of scrutiny would be a welcome relief. We were incredibly frustrated, of course, of not having our hands on the levers of power. And now that they're right in front of us, the heavy burden of actually making decisions confronts us daily. I mean, I should be clear, distant memories opposition may be, but not fond memories. I will never forget getting into the lift with a decent, but not particularly high-performing Liberal minister a few months out from the 2023 election. And of course, my polite inquiries of, you know, how are you going, elicited a long sigh and a tired, oh, you think you want to win, but it's harder than you think. It's not so great. And I remember my jaw dropping open. If you don't want the job, feel free to give it up. There are plenty of us desperate to give it a go. 12 years in government is a long time. Too long, evidently, for some. And the fact that Labor wanted it more, I think, is a major and oftentimes overlooked factor in the 2023 state election result. So now, as I said, the eyes are on us, and rightfully so. Government accountability is at the heart of a functioning democratic process. I hate the cynicism with which many in the community view politicians and the processes by which governments make decisions. The opinion most ordinary people have about me and the political system is deeply confronting. It is uncomfortable to recognise that most people, although they don't know me at all, and of course being a state minister, very few people even recognise me, but most people nonetheless have a very dim opinion of my intelligence, my integrity, and my capacity. And my only consolation is that it's not personal. They feel that way about all politicians. They think of us as corrupt, and they think the system is rigged against them. And of course, that's not true. Imperfect as we are as individuals and defective as the system may be, most politicians are motivated by public service and not self-interest. And they operate in a system intended to make things better, not worse for people. But the deep mistrust about the role of government is a very important factor as to why accountability and oversight of our work is so essential in solving complex problems. And here enters the media. So let's take as accepted that politicians, flawed, yes, but by and large, individuals trying to take the problems of the state and make them better. And if I can't get agreement on that basic principle in this room, let me at least assure you that for
My own personal drive to solve the housing crisis is very genuine. So what sincerely frustrates me in trying to do this work, the work of finding the sensible solutions for the people of New South Wales to the circumstances confronting us in the housing market, is doing that under the microscope of a media lens that is driven by oversimplified slogans, sensationalism, and soundbites. We are living in an area defined by unprecedented connectivity. News and political content, commentary, opinion, analysis, it's constantly, widely, and freely available. And part of me thinks that's a great thing. You know, part of me bemoans the lack of civic education in schools and is deflated by the fact that most people don't even know what the Legislative Council is, let alone the bicameral system, let alone Westminster traditions of government. So that part of me that wants citizens more deeply engaged in our civic processes is really excited that news and opinion and commentary and analysis has been collectivized, that anyone can share and access political content that suits their interests and priorities anywhere all the time. Power to the people. Part of me thinks it's great. And part of me finds some of the opportunities for real-time feedback, whether it's in the form of comments, likes, or shares, a valuable way of testing community sentiment and opinion. You aren't speaking into the wind when you're on social media. I mean, you are often speaking into a viper's nest or a cacophony of noise, but I suppose that's our society and that's democracy. And unpleasant as it is to be called evil or stupid or depraved, hearing feedback from people is part of the job of politicians, and those who can't hack it are in the wrong game. However, for all of the positives that come from this radical opening up of platforms to discourse and dialogue, I am very troubled by the way that this transformation has fueled the rapid rise of misinformation, political echo chambers, and filter bubbles. We have been reduced to policy by soundbite, crushed to the attention span of the modern content consumer or the character limit of a tweet. Try explaining the nuances of development consent in the planning system or the feasibility structures that inhibit the delivery of affordable housing or how the Basel rules for international banking regulation constrain new financing of social housing projects on social media. Those forums are not capable of engaging much beyond screaming about immigrants and landlords. And that's why simple ideas like banning migrants or rent caps often have so much cachet online. They are simple to explain and understand. I mean, forget that they don't work. Because you can meme them, you win the policy battle. And I'm actually, at least for a politician, a relatively adept social media user. Even I feel deflated by the wall of loud, incoherent noise that comes with trying to engage with complex policy dialogue on online platforms. Chris Minns once told me that he deleted social media from his phone because he felt like he was waking up every morning with someone standing at the end of his bed just screaming at him. Now, I haven't quite taken that approach yet, but I'm extremely sympathetic to his point of view. So is the traditional media much better? Well, for starters, it's struggling more and more with market share. Young people are less likely to listen to the radio, read the newspapers, or watch the TV news. And in a conversation that we're having about government accountability as an opportunity to stress test and explore complex challenges that government confronts, it's not a particularly effective form of accountability when no one sees it. The democratic feedback loop breaks down when the bit between people making decisions and people knowing about them collapses. For our purposes though, let's just park the question of market share and perhaps pose the more fundamental question. Is the content in traditional media even worth consuming? Well, of course, there are some exceptional contributors who engage with nuance and impartiality. However, the reality is that there is an increasing growth of players and platforms with agendas who make it difficult to govern effectively. One small but illustrative example in my area of work is the exploration we are conducting into regulation of the short-term rental market. Now, The short-term rental market is hardly the biggest issue in the housing policy ecosystem, but nonetheless, it's a factor that is driving affordability and accessibility challenges, particularly in some specific locations. So we launched a discussion paper with an all options on the table approach to considering policy solutions. Surely this is the type of open-minded and consultative approach we want from government on complicated issues where there's no easy solution and we're balancing interests and priorities. Surely, right? Wrong. Because of the fear around media reaction and scare campaigning on some potential options, there was anxiety almost to the point of paralysis with even launching a discussion paper. Not because the premise was wrong, not because the content or solutions were wrong. I mean, to be clear, it was literally just a presentation of options asking for community feedback, because people feared the way it would be received by the media. And when policy dialogue is stalled or derailed because of the way our media receives and treats complex issues, we are in a political environment that is hostile to reform. Now, sensationalist scare campaigns are nothing new. Reds under the bed, the yellow peril. But I fear that historically, there was some capacity for debate. There was a call and there was a response. There was a back and forth. There was a cadence to the way these issues were discussed in the political ecosystem. Now there's less of that. It's just everyone constantly shouting at each other. Now, as I've said, there are, of course, exceptions who really do try to provide forums for robust and impartial and nuanced dialogue. And perhaps the sweeping way that I am describing the media environment is a sign that I'm guilty of some of the same reductive generalizations. But 1 year into government, I cannot avoid the conclusion that progress possible on complex issues like housing is not well supported by the headline grabbing and agenda driven approach of some loud media voices. And one of the consequences of the environment I have described is that people are either deeply polarized or completely disengaged. And that has made one of the very powerful ways that we can confront complex and challenging problems even more difficult. And that's through unexpected partnerships and alliances. So that ability to reach across the aisle, to share purpose with perhaps an unexpected a political enemy in some ways, those powerful unions can create new perspectives on complex issues. But that type of work where different people from different parts of the political spectrum join together to highlight or put a spotlight on a particular challenge to demonstrate to the community that there were different perspectives coming together, that is all so much more difficult in the environment I've described, because it's met by shrieks and disdain from your own base, who are appalled by any sign of ideological weakness. She's agreeing with who now? What a sellout. I can understand if the idea of me reaching across the aisle might be met with some raised eyebrows, because I will admit that I am known as relatively strident and determined and intense. But I genuinely believe that those who've engaged with me will recognise that I very much value the importance of these robust discussions and being compassionate and considerate of other people's points of view. I want to see more progressive Labor members of government, like myself, at forums like this and on Sky News. I also want to see leaders of conservative political parties actually engaged on TikTok and sitting down with, not sneering at The Guardian. Those types of things used to be a lot easier for politicians to do. It used to be a lot easier to engage with different platforms, to speak to different audiences, to link up with erstwhile political opponents. Nowadays, in the deeply polarized environment in which we operate, it's really risky for a politician to form those kind of collaborations, lest your own base desert you and see it as a sign of weakness. I want to be clear that I am for a culture of dialogue and listening, but not one that freezes progress. So when I talk about consultation and collaboration and dialogue, I mean doing that, but not at the expense of moving forward. We cannot be about progress only by consensus. Government is not a 19th century salon or debating society. It is about being prepared to compromise, adjust, move forward, but with some flexibility, not putting consultation as some kind of roadblock or diversion from reform. We need a media environment that fosters engagement, that fosters flexibility, that doesn't deride a willingness to bend or find a middle ground as a back down or a backflip. I mean, I sometimes think that like a backflip is a really awesome skill to have in everyday life, but in political land, it's seen as a sign of failure. Saul Alinsky has a quote I like on this. "The human spirit glows from the inner light of doubt about whether we are right. Those who believe with certainty that they possess the right answer are dark inside and darken the world around them." The media should amplify those inner lights, allow politicians to struggle with complex issues, express doubt, express uncertainty, not force us to darken the world by pretending that we are right all the time. So I've had some choice words to say about the media's role in making difficult and lasting change, but of course, it's unhelpful and inaccurate to pretend that that's the beginning and the end of the stories. Politicians themselves are a big part of the problem. They can be timid, they can be easily distracted, they can be trapped in endless four-year loops that prioritise electoral timetables over long-term reform. They are either Icaruses, energetic visionaries whose impatience brings them crashing back down to earth, or Neros who are endlessly fiddling and equivocating while the world crashes and burns around them. Now, of course, like the media, I don't mean all politicians. And I'm optimistic, actually, that the new generation of political leaders in New South Wales from across the political spectrum represent a real break from the caricatures I've described above. Case in point, Chris Minns and Dom Perrottet. These two leaders showed it was possible to disagree in elections without being jerks about it. And it wasn't just the willingness to avoid personal potshots, which was commendable, it was the genuine effort to contest elections on policy grounds. What do we think of the future role of privatisation? How do we manage the wages and conditions of public sector workers? Is the health and hospital system functioning well or not? We can genuinely disagree on these matters and contest the right to make decisions about them. And we can do that in a way that doesn't end up promoting a political culture that undermines the capacity of any or all politicians to make decisions and confront difficult challenges. When we argue that our opponents are evil or terrible and shred their credibility just because we want to win an election, it's a race to the bottom. And we're arguing over who loses last, because ultimately we all lose. These New South Wales leaders, I feel, have not just tried to create good cultures, they've also heavily invested in forums that genuinely promote bipartisanship. And not bipartisanship just as a word that we throw around to try and sound centrist, but formal structures that are based on this principle. And the obvious example is National Cabinet and the Ministerial Councils. Now, I don't praise Scott Morrison for much, but I think that National Cabinet and the Ministerial Councils were a genuinely good concept. And both Minns and Perrottet have grasped the opportunity presented. It's not that every effort to make complicated issues bipartisan has been successful, but the good instincts to try and make that work before flicking the switch to attack mode is promising. Chris has demonstrated these good instincts on housing too. So on each and every occasion there has been an opportunity to bring people on the journey of reform, he has taken it. I've personally briefed Mark Speakman with the Planning Minister Paul Scully on work to reform the planning system, asking directly for engagement and support. Chris himself has reached out to local government leaders across Sydney to try and find common ground, calling mayor after mayor to extend offers of dialogue and flexibility if shared goals of increasing housing supply are supported. From Saul Alinsky to Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who has a quote that illustrates this point, "Fight like hell for what you believe in, but do it in a way that brings people with you." It's not about not believing in things, but if politicians want to make lasting change on complex issues, they have to be willing to invest the time and the energy and the effort to bring people on the journey. Confidence in the outcome is only half the point. Plenty of people have good ideas, but never get the chance to see them flourish because they forget the art of persuasion in politics. Not everyone is going to agree with your idea, even if it's a great idea when you first put it out there. And it does take time and energy and effort and unexpected alliances and reaching across the aisle and trying to find common ground to bring people on that journey. And I hope if I've done nothing else with my speech tonight, I have demonstrated that I at least am committed to the art and skill of persuasion. My willingness to show up to audiences and platforms, not necessarily predisposed to my point of view on every issue, is a hope, not a vain hope, a real hope, that such effort will be rewarded, not necessarily by agreement, but by a recognition that this is the work we all have to do if we are determined to see the wicked problems of our age confronted in a serious and lasting way. Thank you.
Well, thanks for the Minister for a lively, and I think the word you used was feisty, a feisty speech. So we'll now come to questions and discussion. If you come, and we've seen you on Sky News, and this speech will run on Sky News, so there you go. Just come back here, and I'll just start off. So you start, well, thanks for a very lively speech, as I said. So you start off by saying that you're one of the most progressive people in the New South Wales Parliament, and that's on the Labor side. But a bit over a week ago, you were on Q&A, and you were doing your progressive bit.
I was doing my shtick, yes.
But the real difficulty didn't really come from sort of loud media voices. It came from one of the Greens with a hyphenated name, as the Prime Minister mentions. He thought there were twice as many Greens because they all had hyphenated names. So Max Chandler Mather was sort of going at you. So he sounded like a loud media voice, but he's a member of the House of Representatives. Mm. So you talk
to
the end of it.
I mean, Max is a great example of that point that I was trying to make in my speech about someone who's unwilling to acknowledge the complexity of difficult issues. I mean, his view is that, you know, the Commonwealth government should reform its tax settings around negative gearing and capital gains tax. Okay, that's fine. You know, he's entitled to an opinion on a policy matter such as that. But on the Q&A panel, what was incredibly illuminating to me was how dogmatic he was. And, you know, I do see this with, to be honest, a lot of progressives, particularly those from fringe parties. There is an unbelievable dogma. I have the answer. I am right. You know, both the major parties are crooked and corrupt. And if only they just did exactly what I said, the problem would be solved. Does he actually believe that? I mean, sure, I see it as a political tactic. And I guess that's what I think is sad. That surely you would recognise that in a conversation about housing, maybe Commonwealth tax settings are part of it, but so is the planning system, so is migration, so is local government. These are complex and nuanced challenges, and when you contribute to the debate in such a way that fails to even acknowledge that that's the case, I think it really diminishes our capacity to solve those problems in a nuanced way. I think it's not true. I think it's unfair to the Australian people to pretend that there's one answer, to pretend, oh, well, if you just did this, the problem would be solved. No, it wouldn't. It wouldn't. And we should be honest. So as I said, either he genuinely believes that, in which case that is a very limited and inaccurate understanding of our challenges in housing, or he doesn't believe it, but he's doing it as a political tactic because that's what gets the grab, gets the claps, gets people saying, oh, well, I think he has an answer, so I'll go with that. And as I said, I think it's very disappointing. And what I also don't like about the approach from some of those minor parties is the way that they just, with a sweeping generalisation, the major parties, they're just sort of crooked and corrupt and in the pockets of the property industry. What nonsense. What absolute nonsense. Now, again, you know, I've got my criticisms of the Liberal Party and they've got valid criticisms of the Labor Party. But it diminishes all of us when you trash talk the political system like that. Say their policies are not the policies that I ideologically support, and here's why. Completely valid, completely fair enough. Don't say they're corrupt, they're crooked, their capacity to make decisions is compromised, because then you're undermining the entire political system. And I think that's a really sad part of the way that debate can be conducted. So those would be some of my reflections on the contributions of people like Max to the debates that we're having.
So can I congratulate you? That was a wonderful speech. I don't agree with your philosophical approach at all, but I think it was really about dialogue, political dialogue. Can I ask you to give us six alternatives for solving the problem of the housing crisis in Sydney?
So six is a bit hard, but anyway.
Well, I mean, okay.
Very smart.
Well, I mean, we need to reform the planning system, but there'd be a few drop-down boxes under that, which might get me closer to the six. So obviously we need to get housing approval numbers up. We need to approve more houses to be built. That would be one. The next thing is that's only half, well, not even half the problem, that's only part of the problem. Even once we have the approvals done, we need to make the financing of those projects feasible, viable. I mean, 95% of housing is delivered by the private market. It's fine, good, that's the way it is. So they're only going to make decisions to actually turn a piece of paper approval into a project that they're building if it's viable, if it's feasible. And that's not straightforward at the moment. Some of that is to do with the way that the banking system is very risk averse. And I mean, look, our strong banking system has been a fantastic part of our underpinning our economic prosperity, but they're incredibly cautious. So definitely feasibility. The second part of that, and this is going to get me to three, is government's feasibility structure. So as well as being the Minister for Housing, I'm the Minister for Water. And you can't build houses unless they're connected to water, for drinking water and for sewerage. Turns out that that's a major roadblock in the delivery of housing, because so many of those processes take an unbelievable amount of time, like a shockingly bureaucratic quagmire amount of time. So that is definitely something that we need to crack through. So even then, you've got your planning approval, you've got your finance, you've got your government approvals done. Where are you going to get the workers to build it? I mean, we do have genuine skill shortages. So another thing that government really has to do is get skills working. I mean, you know, obviously I'm going to say Labor has a good plan to invest in TAFE, which we do. But nonetheless, that worker piece, that skilled worker piece, is an incredibly important part of the work that we have to do. Two others that I'll add, because we're trying to get to six. One, and this five is linked to four, which is one of the ways that we can do that, other than investing in new skills, is thinking about new ways to build houses. So traditional methods of construction, been around for 50 years or so. Modern methods of construction, houses made in factories, transported, constructed on site. Forget the crappy demountables you think you know. These are quality products, quality housing products. I've been in them, I would live in them. So that's another thing government can really heavily do, boost that sector, which also has the added benefit of supporting domestic manufacturing, which, you know, I think is a positive thing. So we really need to invest in the modern methods of construction, how we deliver the new houses. And the last one, I did get to six, is what we do to better utilise the housing stock we have. Because the first five were all about building new houses, which I think is incredibly important. The last one is, yeah, how do we address the fact that there's a lot of housing stock that's underutilised? And that was the short-term rental review that we're looking at. I do think there is more that we could and should do to incentivise, encourage people to have their primary place of residence, but other properties they might own on the long-term rental market. And I think that, as I said, I am no way a person that believes that's going to solve the problem. But as one of the six things we could do, there is a piece of work that would look to bring perhaps, you know, tens of thousands of properties onto the long-term rental market, and I think that would be a good thing.
Hi. Ulrike Stracker is my name. I'm the Austrian Consul and Trade Commissioner. We've been looking at the housing crisis, as Premier Minns describes, and your, yes, we've been looking at the housing crisis and hearing about it, and people suggested that Austria could contribute something by showing its policy on social housing. And there is one other thing that we are trying to contribute. We'll have a stand at Sydney Built with some of our cross-laminated timber companies, because those are exactly the materials to build houses in a quicker way. Mm. But I was wondering whether it would be interesting for you to look at the Austrian experience. Mm. And okay. I'd be ready to
I'd love that.
Contact.
Yeah, yeah, we can connect. I'd love that. We should connect up afterwards. Certainly, you know, you mentioned social housing. And whilst I've taken as, well, my broad theme, complex challenges, my example, my case in point housing, my actual responsibility as Minister for Housing is primarily for government housing, for public housing, for social housing. That's my day-to-day. I don't do planning. I don't do the sort of feasibility treasury side. So I'd love to look at examples internationally. And certainly, as I said, I think 95% of our housing is private market housing, privately owned. Only 5% is government housing in New South Wales. And that's problematic. As I said, you know, I made that reference to the point that, sure, a big part of the conversation we have is about how the people with middle-class jobs can't get housing, but the consequences of that on the most vulnerable are very significant. And, you know, as that breaks down, as I said, our cities become more unsafe, social cohesion begins to fray, and we end up, you know, as a moving towards other cities that we know internationally have experienced very significant housing inequality. And that's not a Sydney that I want to live in. So I'd love to draw on international examples about social housing and government housing to think about what we might do in Sydney to make that a more viable alternative for people.
Thank you for that. It's a more or less follow-up question. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening to the Rose Hill racecourse? Because it might provide an opportunity to follow what they did at Letchworth in England, where they eliminated the cost of land, which halves the price of housing, by making the land self-financing in a mutual fund owned by the residents. So you've halved the cost of housing, but you need a large bit of land like Rose Hill to make it work so okay. You can have a proper mix of residential
okay.
factories.
Yep.
Oh, sir, I love that suggestion. And in fact, what we do to identify land, government land, but also potentially other sites, is a key part of the work that we're doing. Now, I can't give you an answer as to what's happening at Rose Hill because we're going through the process of the Australian Turf Club members voting on the future use of that. So any ATC members in the audience or watching, please support the government's housing. I mean, you know, they're going through that process, which they're entitled to do. They own that land. They can make a decision about whether they wish to, you know, sell it to government as part of this. But the point that you make is an extremely valid one, which is, yeah, that's right. And land is the big cost. I mean, I think most people in this room probably recognise that. Land is the fundamental driver for housing costs in Sydney. So any opportunity, as you have described, for us to look differently at how we do value and use land is critical here. And as I said, we have a separate piece of work than the piece of work at Rose Hill about identifying unused government land. And look, sometimes they're smaller sites, as you say, less options, sometimes slightly bigger sites. But if we own the land, then we can be thoughtful about how it's valued and how we deliver housing on it in a way that is feasible. So that audit of government land is well underway. It's nearing completion. And it's a significant part of the work that we're doing because having to rely on the private market to bring land, you know, to the table is challenging.
Thank you. Wonderful talk. Hope you learnt some of those, that consultation philosophy across the metaphorical aisle at Sydney University a long time ago. Question on governance. Do you think that there should be more detailed exposure bills so that the public can put considered input into legislation before it's set in stone? And on that theme, what is your view on selective consultations with non-disclosure arrangements attached to them? Do they concern you?
Yeah. Okay.
Yep. Yes, I think it's a great question, Robin. And I mean, fundamentally, yes, they do. I have just an example in the area that I'm working in, the Minister for Mental Health, as well as housing and water and all those other things. And we have committed to doing a whole of government suicide prevention legislation in New South Wales. So it's a relatively novel concept. They have one in South Australia, Japan, South Korea, Canada, a couple of other jurisdictions. As we're working on the legislative development process, the advice that we're receiving is can't show anyone, can't talk to anyone, because it's a cabinet in confidence process. And I am finding this incredibly difficult and incredibly challenging. And to be honest, looking at ways to push back, because fundamentally I am of the view that exposure bills, you know, that the being open through the whole process of legislative development leads to better outcomes. And I'm not in favour of locking that down and saying, well, until the final piece of legislation has been through cabinet, it's all cabinet in confidence and no one can really see or know about it. And in particular, in my area of suicide prevention, I think this is a real risk that we end up coming up with a bill that isn't informed by lived experience, by carer feedback, by clinical expertise and evidence. What a waste of time and money this will be for government. If we produce a piece of legislation on suicide prevention that is fundamentally rejected by the kind of people and organisations who it's intended to serve because they feel as though they have been locked out of the process, because no one asked them, what do you think? No one said to them, here, sit, co-design this with us, then well, we'll have wasted time, we'll have wasted money, and we'll produce a piece of legislation that will not have its intended impact. So I'm very much in favour of trying to produce a suicide prevention bill that is owned not just by the New South Wales government, but is owned by the community who care about that issue, the people who want to be involved in its drafting and development and design. But yes, I am bumping up against those same tendencies, and I think that's really problematic. And certainly I'm quite interested in pushing back on, no, we can have processes that bring people in without compromising the important principles of confidential cabinet deliberations and produce better outcomes for the government and the community.
Minister Louise Waterhouse, I'm also the Consul General for the Kingdom of Tonga. So, but I have a couple of things because your speech has been
No, got one thing. Okay. A lot of people here. Okay.
All right. Well, first of all, from the suicide prevention, having had a suicide over the weekend, I'd be very pleased to be able to have a chance to talk with you about opportunities. But on the real issue,
Yes.
We talked about Rose Hill, and you probably know that's quite a problematic thing because the members were not informed about it. But the critical thing to making something like that happen is to find an alternate site. And also, we talked about the cost of land. Why don't we look at, say, the Canberra model or the model that we have in other countries like New Zealand, where we do long-term leasing or rental of land. People can build their houses and take out a 50-year lease or so and so. And that would really solve a major problem. That's it.
Yes, look, I mean, I'm sorry to hear about that. And look, Louise, it's just an example of why I think that process that I was describing in response to Robin's question is so important, because people do care. They want government to do better, and they have opinions and experiences that could help us do a good job. And if we lock ourselves in, we lose all of that valuable insight. Anyway, we might be able to touch base about making that work later. But in response to your question about more creative uses of land, again, we are extremely open to those. So long-term lease models, I think have ground lease models, are definitely things we should explore. Again, the challenge is because land is so expensive in Sydney and in New South Wales, some of those models make the feasibility of projects quite challenging. Nonetheless, I'm not interested in just having problems. We need to find ways to make them work. So we are exploring that. Land lease communities is another one. Community lands trust. There are different ways. There are creative options for how we can confront the housing affordability issues that we're dealing with. But as I said, it goes back to the theme of my talk, which is when we lock ourselves into, well, we've got to do negative gearing, or we've got to do rent caps, or we just need to cap immigration, or it's just this one thing, all of those different, out-of-the-box, creative ideas from other jurisdictions or from bright minds in our own jurisdiction are sort of lost in the wall of noise with the people, the charlatans, in a way, I will say, who are pretending, oh, well, there's just this one thing that you can do. And so I really value people who say, well, actually, what about this idea? But I guess I'm reflecting on some of the challenges that we've found in government with really exploring them and breathing life into them. But fundamentally, we are trying. We are trying to look at ways that we can do things a little bit differently.
Before we go to the next question, I just want to say that the Minister is also the Minister for Mental Health, the Minister for Youth, and the Minister for the North Coast, which explains some of those questions.
Yes,
there's a question here.
Back to housing and the connection between the land and the value of the home. The retirement village sort of model seems to be going gangbusters to me, and that's got a disconnect between land and the cost of housing. And the standardisation of houses and to scope down the size of houses, stop building McMansions and things like this, that all seems to play to a model to me. And I don't know how it can be extended or not.
Oh, you're right. So, I mean, the reference to land lease communities, that's essentially the model that retirement villages use. And as I said, community lands trusts are a slight tweak on that, but it's that fundamental concept that you have described. I agree that we are seeing the proliferation of them for seniors living at the moment and for all of the very good reasons. I think you're right. We need to look at the way that we should make them available more broadly. My view, and you know, it is informed by talking to some in the sector, it's going to be much harder to do that in Sydney. In Sydney, where land is, as I said, very expensive, it's difficult to get a model to work where the rent that you are paying on the land is feasible to make the overall project work. It's not that I'm saying it's impossible, but you start getting to rent costs, land rent costs that are very expensive. But we can look at that. It's really in regional areas that I think we should start to really try and grow this model. And, you know, that also have the benefit of having a bit more land available. But I think in regional New South Wales, I mean, I know a number of the developers now, like I think Stockland have got one that's, you know, good and new. I mean, at the moment, they're like quite luxury options. As you say, the houses are smaller, but often that's what people are looking for, and they've got incredible community amenities. So I do think that is a very good and solid option, particularly for people who are looking to downsize and, you know, who want to sort of buy into a community like that. But, I mean, fundamentally, I think we have to explore what we can do to make them more widely available. I mean, it is a model that can work. But as I said, I'm unsure about its capacity in Sydney in the short term. Yes, no, we should. That's another conversation. Yeah. But a good one.
Minister, I don't doubt your competence. I have huge competence, and I wish you luck. But housing and water, you have a tiger by the tail, and that might be an understatement.
Thank you.
Yes, it is. Minister, that was a terrific talk. A discussion today with someone in the housing industry, we were considering the problem, and it's only a small niche, but you talked about making the best of the housing we have. What about the single widow person who's living in a house that doesn't have to be in a luxurious area anymore in Sydney, that maybe if sold would bring $2 to $3 million, and living on a pension, and they don't want to lose their pension, so they stay living in this family home that's far too big and probably not being looked after as it should be because they don't want to lose the benefits? Is there a way around that, a way of encouraging people by not maybe losing a pension?
Yeah, I mean, well, one of the things, you know, the issue of encouraging downsizing is challenging, and also often because there's not enough housing supply, often I'll hear people in that circumstance say to me, I'd be willing to do that, but I don't want to leave this my area. You know, I want to stay in the community that I have roots. And the options, the alternative housing options, aren't there for them. There isn't the larger apartment or the duplex or the townhouse, the smaller option. That is not available. So I do think part of it is literally building those options so that people might go, well, sure, I can stay in the community that I like and there's a viable alternative place for me to live. So that's one part of it. I do think this issue of what we can do, if people, particularly if they want to stay in the home that they've grown up with and they raise their family in, to allow them to have people stay with them without it impacting their pension is a significant one. And we've done some preliminary advocacy with the Commonwealth about this, but I'm going to sort of try and, you know, ramp it up a little bit. It is my view that a huge barrier for those people to renting out a room in their house, which many of them would be willing to do and in fact would love the company, is because, as you say, it negatively impacts their pension and they're not going to do that. And so that, I think, is definitely something that we can be looking at. I mean, in the UK, they have models where people in that circumstance, even if they're not on the pension, are able to access tax breaks if they do that. So if you live in a larger house with a spare room and you rent out that room, they've trialled models where there are tax incentives to do that. Again, I think these are things that we should be looking at. You know, it's I don't like doing the shtick, the state government shtick, where I say, oh, well, actually, here are all these things the Commonwealth should do, but ultimately that's not my responsibility. I really try and take ownership of the things the state can do. But of course, Anne, it is true that the Commonwealth tax settings and these kind of arrangements could be doing more to incentivise the kind of things that you're describing. And ultimately, I would be supportive of that. And my understanding of the UK model is that it was quite successful, that they actually did have a number of people take advantage of those tax incentives to rent out rooms in their property, and that did provide a good solution for them and for people who are looking for a place to stay. So ultimately, again, back to looking at international examples, we should be exploring that.
I've got a question on Zoom. And the person points out that you start off by saying that one of the reasons you thought that Labour won a year ago was because they wanted to win more than the coalition did. But then you went on to say that what was good about the campaign was that the Premier and the opposition leader were besties. Did the Premier really want to win that hard?
Yeah, I mean, I think he did. I mean, I guess my sense is that when I think back to the campaign, as I said, it seems like a distant memory. I feel like it was a bit unfair. Like, I feel like in part it was, you know, 21 against one. Like, other than the former Premier Dom Perrottet, I don't necessarily think that, you know, a number of the senior ministers had tapped out. They weren't running again. They didn't feature prominently in the campaign. You know, I did feel like the Labor team were much more energetic, present, engaged. That's my sense, you know, of one of the reasons why we were successful. But yeah, I mean, I think the two examples that I would give were the Nazi costume and the former premier. When people may not remember, it was sort of little issue in the campaign. There was issue about his wife hurting her back. Dom Perrottet's wife hurting her back, and an ambulance was called. And on both occasions, there would have been an opportunity in a nasty campaign for real personal pot shots, you know, Chris to come out and be really personal and nasty about Dom Perrottet. And on both occasions, temptation resisted. You know, Chris, you know, Premier Perrottet's genuine contrition about the costume issue and, you know, the issue with his wife just went, well, that's family, leave him out of it. And so I do think those are examples of running hard on issues, being relentless about privatisation or the wages cap or whatever issues Labor was campaigning on. But on those specific occasions where you could have gotten nasty, taken the low blow, you know, made a kind of personal jibe, attack someone's character, I think, you know, Chris rightfully avoided that. And I think that is an example of the way that, you know, you can take a deep breath and, even though it might be tempting to kick someone when they're having a bad moment, go, actually, no, it's not necessary. Let's keep focused on the issues.
I have a question. Minister, in 3 years' time, you'll be going to the polls again. And I've heard it said from a federal standpoint that the party that unlocks the secret to the housing crisis, or whatever else you want to call it, all these problems you've identified that you're wanting to try and address, is going to really have the sort of pathway to power. Are there, of the ones that you've listed, in a couple of years' time or leading into the next state election, are you wanting to be able to say to the electorate, we've made tangible progress on number one, number two? Which issues do you think are going to be what you're going to be able to say to the electorate, we've made progress on?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say two things. One, the obvious example is reform of the planning system. Are we getting more houses approved or not? And two, commence construction. You know, have we made that link between you've got your planning approval done and you're starting the work on construction? It obviously is going to be challenging to complete, to have built the number of houses that we need in that time. But those would be two examples of areas where it would be important to point to progress. But second point that I would make, and I referenced it in my speech, whilst I don't disagree with you that if you could find a way to fundamentally turn around the housing crisis, you would be doing well politically, that can't be the consideration. I can't operate in a four-year electoral cycle, what have I got to do to get through the next election? That kind of thinking, I mean, obviously I want to win the next election. Clearly I don't want to go back to opposition. Nonetheless, you know, in housing, and I say this to myself, you have to remain focused on that medium and longer term. The politics of it can't be your driving motivation. You can't be doing it because you think it's good politics or because you're working in a four-year electoral cycle. You have to do it because you believe it is the right thing for Sydney. And I do. I believe Sydney is going to become a very unequal and unfair and boring and dull and lifeless place unless we can find opportunities for younger people, young professionals, young families to stay here and live here. And that's what motivates me. And that's going to take more than 3 years. That is going to take more than 3 years. And so, you know, there would be some things in answer to your question that I think we have to do. And I do hope that the electorate will see the progress that is being made. But fundamentally, I'm not about the next election. I'm about the issue, which I believe is a genuine one, and the timetable for that is going to be longer term. And I think I've just, you know, it's important that politicians do believe that and also communicate that and are honest with people about the fact that these complex challenges do take time to solve. And here's the plan that we have and the approach that we're taking and the work that we're doing, but not selling, you know, people some, you know, snake oil that, you know, with some little plan, you know, policy here or change there, it's all going to be solved overnight and, you know, vote for me, vote one rose. No, it's not like that. And that's the point in a way that I was trying to communicate in my speech. And I think more politicians need to more regularly have that dialogue. And actually the community is so much smarter, I think, than a lot of politicians often give them credit for. They, as I said, we can be very reductive and use, you know, generalizations and pretend that people don't understand the nuance. Of course they do. So I think doing more of that is what is very valuable.
Many thanks. So there are a lot of people here tonight, and it's a warm night in Sydney. So I just want to say thanks to the Minister, Rose Jackson, for not only a great speech, but a great feisty performance. So well done, and we'll have you back again sometime. Thank you very much. Thanks, folks.